in our culture, we need to reclaim passion, because we've let passion fall only in the eros side of things, and I don't understand that that passion is much more than that, includes that, but much more than that. And so having passion, which for me I define having compassion as the ability to have a deep sense of care for both oneself and for the other being those that we live in community with, but also as importantly, those people that we might call a stranger. And so the question I have is, what might vocation have to do with compassion? And of course, citizenship. Let me move on to citizenship. Citizenship is both narrow and broad. When we think of citizenship, we tend to think of it within the boundary of our nationalism. So I'm a citizen of Canada, or I'm a citizen of etc. What I want to suggest is that there are probably three or four dimensions of citizenship, membership in. One is that you do have citizenship in both your local and your state and your national government, whatever those are, or provincial government. But most importantly, we are also citizens of the world. We share this planet, we share this environment, and it has no boundaries. And so when I think about citizenship in the context I'm using it for our dialogue today, it's both broad and narrow. You will notice I put next to citizenship the term virtual realities. Virtual realities have to do with what I call being a global village, member of a global village, and understanding that membership may take on different shapes depending on your interest and depending on the particular networks that you find yourself a member of. And so the place for citizenship, I think, will take on variable dimensions depending on where your focus is right now. And I want to explore that with the group in terms of vocation, compassion, and citizenship. Now, I have a term on there called the Great Work. And I define the Great Commission as the Great Work. That's the great work of the universe. Great work that we were called to do and to express in the universe and with people we know, of course. And I believe that compassion and citizenship has something to do with it. It is at least a dimension of it. And so part of what I'm interested in hearing from you today is your thoughts about not only vocation, compassion, and citizenship, but its linkage to doing the great work. And the great work is, as in Acts, we're called Christians. That's both name and vocation. So, with that said, I've come up with three questions that I think ought to take up a little bit of our time today. The first question is, what does compassion have to do with work, vocation, and citizenship? And I'd like to do those separately. The second question is, what is the great work for our time? And the third question is, to what new vocations might we be called based on the great work for our time? I think that ought to be enough for this afternoon, don't you think? So, why don't we get started? I want to hear from folks, so let's start with, what does compassion have to do with work?
You're talking about compassion and spirited action now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's a certain relationship of dedication in that spirit of compassion. And that becomes important both in your own work If you're not dedicated to it, you're not going to do a good job. But also in terms of the great work.
So if you lack, in your, what you're saying is if you lack compassion in what you do, that diminishes what
both
you
do. Both sides.
Both sides. Both the work and the great work. What might be an example, and this is for other people as well as yourself?
Well, you know, one of the things in our day and age that where there are great opportunities for the great work is for people who have a vocation, have an opportunity to go all over the world and there to share the gospel. And do it a lot better sometimes than the missionaries can do it because they're doing it non-professionally.
Uh-huh. You mean like some of the people in some of the parts of South Central America that are helping people set up co-ops?
Well, maybe like that, but maybe also just, I work for IBM. I'm sent to Egypt. I'm sitting right there in the center of Mohammedism where they have a very difficult time to share the gospel, but where you may share the gospel in your home, in a private witness, you can reach out. It's being done. Incidentally, the Mohammedans are the greatest ones in doing this because the Mohammedan, no matter where he goes, is the witness. And some of our people are afraid. The fact is, we've been sort of told, you know, in our culture, you shouldn't go over there and annoy somebody's religion. You know, if someone's a Mohammedan, you shouldn't even think of sharing your faith with them.
Yeah, also the other, it's interesting you should bring this up because IBM, you also have the opportunity to bear witness to other Christians. Particularly in some of the European countries, often as have been asked, at least when I've been on stints, why is it that you're a Christian? Don't you believe that stuff? You know, people see crosses in your home or the Bible, and it draws them into conversation. And I had a dialogue with someone for 2 years. The last year of his life, he had cancer. And finally, in the last week of his life, he asked me, would it be okay for him to accept Jesus? He says, I know you're not going to believe this, but you're going to, you know, of course, at that point, it's like, I'm like speechless.
Yeah.
But it was a 2-year conversation. I wasn't out to do that. That was not the intention. I just hoped somehow he'd come to know God. So it's interesting that you, two things I heard in that. One is that the lack of passion for what you do has impact on the quality of what you do and the quality of the great work, which is, I think, makes some sense. And I think it's one of those questions we have to confront ourselves with.
And I saw lack of compassion as not the, a lot of people aren't willing to take the risk to go to these places.
Yes.
I mean, Europe is easy.
Yeah.
Iran or Iraq would be difficult. Mm-hmm. Particularly for the wife.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a very different set of rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be difficult for me personally, yes. Your response.
On the relationship between work and compassion, more and more what I am hearing from people with jobs is there's downsizing as there is less permanence in jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And more work for less money. There's less, there's maybe less personal resources and less time and less ability to be compassionate with them. Mm-hmm. The job, one example is a friend of mine is the director of LSS, providing a lot of social, it's a big agency in Minnesota because there's many Lutherans living in social services. And she just is moving down from being in charge of the whole office because she's so tired of the stress of seeing that more and more of the people she's putting in positions are squeezed into being told exactly how they can serve people and for how long and for what types of service and all this, and she just has been working for so long to try to keep some creativity and some compassion within this role of being compassionate. I mean, the job is to be therapists and counselors, and I mean, it's the very definition of being compassionate, and yet the constraints in that job have become so tight that she doesn't see the people being able to do what they've been trained to do. Mm-hmm. And then she can't see how she can be compassionate to them. She says right now their unit in the whole state of Minnesota has more free time than any other unit, more in service. She's done all the things she can do to try and make that job humane. And I think that's, you know, that's one that's probably less impacted than another place. I'm on a bank, regional advisory board, and they're downsizing more and more. They're asking people to do less, more and more, for less and less money, so they have less time and less chance to put in compassion. They just have to kind of crank it up, you know.
That's why I hung the quote up about drudgery. Want to read it?
All work contains drudgery. The issue is whether it holds meaning or not.
Yes. And see, I always ask the question, so what's the drudgery index on this job? Because we all have them. And so if you miss, so you combine drudgery with a de-escalation of compassion or passion, or something that attracts compassion, then you have a fairly deadening situation, of which I would advise people to get out of. Because the more people that do that, it's sort of like this, when people stop buying hamburgers, McDonald's will find another way. So people stop taking dead-end jobs or jobs that have no lack of passion or where you can't bring your passion, then you've got to really sort of think about other alternatives. It's unfortunate that some social service agencies are having that experience, but on the other hand, some new social service agencies are being birthed that are smaller, more agile, more fluid, where people can show up with their passion, albeit they may be making less money. But again, we decided the other day in our discussion that you can either decide you want to drink the Kool-Aid and be sort of go that route, or that you're going to seek out a way for you to be able to show up more fully. And particularly because when we're dealing with some social economic groups, people who are highly educated, well-educated, have that freedom, and I just want to acknowledge that some people who don't have the education don't have some of those freedoms to move up and down. You can make a decision that you're going to live a certain way because your education really does give you that fluidity. When you're not educated, that's the problem. You are a little bit more stuck. You know, so I want to just acknowledge that. Yes.
That's a big thing nowadays. You take the people who just aren't capable of having a college education, there's not the good paying jobs.
No.
It's either McDonald's or nothing, you know.
That's right. In fact, skill, that I believe will be the next major political issue, which is what I call fair pay or living pay wage, as well as work that requires skill, but you don't have to be Einstein to do it, quality of work. And that is going to be a major issue.
I think another way, and this is something what you were saying, what, in terms of compassion and work, is that there are some work environments that acknowledge and respect the people as people with many talents, that they have many sides to them, and that they're not just work units,
yeah,
or there to produce a product, and that they have feelings, they want a sense of accomplishment in what they do, they want to feel good about their work, to have an environment where they can be successful, to grow, and that also recognizing that people have other parts of their lives, their family, their spiritual life, their leisure time, and that their whole, I mean, it's probably companies would most like to have a whole group of workaholics that they can just rotate through and will produce a lot, but it's not very humane, it's not very compassionate to those people that are working for you, to realize that there are people that are working for you and have feelings and, you know, and all sorts of talents and balance in their life, and and not take advantage of people's economic needs or insecurities or whatever.
Tell them what you do.
What do I do?
Yeah.
I'm a systems analyst, a computer analyst. And I struggle with it, you know, with my work environment, because it particularly we had a vice president that referred to us as work units, and we just need arms and legs. I mean, we were just work units. And it's changed, but, you know, it's basically how many systems you can get out of
periods of time. Yeah, it's a mechanistic world. Yeah.
And what did you refer to him as?
Well, probably shouldn't mention that.
She's a Christian woman.
At least I try to be.
Yeah, that's right.
when he says arms and legs, he also must mean heads. You have to have...
No, we're interchangeable. We're literally work units. I mean, it's a very skilled profession, and we have to have a lot of knowledge. But literally, we were work units.
There's so many.
We didn't even have to have brains. Honest, he would just bring in some arms and legs to write those programs. Really, he said that.
I mean, oh yeah. The morale at times was something.
Well, which gets me to this question now. You raised this question about people who do not have education, or what we might call in our environment, in our world, laborers, people who build Chrysler cars or make chips. Because computer chips, microchips, because some skills used for certain kinds of chips are not necessarily used for a different kind. So sometimes those people find their skills are obsolete. Which really begins to connect the notion of compassion work, the great work, to citizenship. And I really want to have us talk about what is citizenship? What does that mean? I want to talk about that first, and then
I'm going to go backwards. I'm sorry.
Go, please.
I got here late. So I hear you saying compassion and passion, and I sort of know what passion is, but I'm trying to understand how we're defining compassion.
Let's ask some people in before I do that. Let's hear from some of the other folks. But why don't we toss that one around? You want to understand what compassion means. Go ahead.
Is it passion or compassion?
Compassion.
I guess as I would understand it, passion is just, it's just phenomenal feeling for something, and the feeling can be negative, positive, whatever. Compassion is literally a feeling with a person, so it is going to take on more of a positive nature than just plain sheer passion. Can be beat out violence, whereas compassion, it is, as I would understand, will always be worked out in some kind of caring and taking into oneself the feelings of the people with whom you're working.
Compassion is the ability to feel and experience God's great gift to us. And his great gift to us was Jesus. And to me, that is the essence of compassion. And our job is to somehow be able to, as best we can in our human capacity, to emulate, to strive for, to have that level of care and heart for our child, our friends, strangers, etc. But you can't sort of have compassion without first understanding the compassion that God had for you. That's how I define compassion. See, some people can care, but they have no... They can care from a mental standpoint. They're just good people. But I take it to a deeper level. But argue with me about that.
We were just having a conversation. One of the thoughts that comes to mind for me is when your source of compassion comes from God, it could be that the level or the amount of compassion you can, the amount of heart or care you can give to another is something that is constantly renewed, whereas when you depend solely on yourself, I think at some point there's a bottom mm-hmm. or a limit.
The well could become dry.
Yeah.
In that definition of, maybe I got it wrong, but in that definition you proposed for compassion, aren't you, as we heard earlier with some other announcement, eliminating about 60% of Oregonians or something who are unchurched? I mean, aren't there people who are secular, who are Hindu, who are Muslim?
That's why I threw the definition
have,
out. Good.
Have equal access or equal capability from the heart of being compassionate. Once we start feeling that because we're Christian or Lutheran, that we have somehow a monopoly on compassion, I think that leads to a horrible hubris.
For sure. Let's hear from other people. What do you think about compassion?
I think I would agree with more of what you said, or that if your source of compassion is God and not yourself, that the well may not run dry, but your understanding then of what that God is. Therefore, we understand as Christians, and maybe someone else can reach God. It's a pretty big jump that someone else could reach God through Muhammad and still understand God's compassion, but in a different culture and in a different way.
Okay.
It's kind of verbalized in a hospital. I work in a Catholic hospital, and it's a Benedictine hospital, and they have what's called a rule of St. Benedict. And one of the things they verbalize in their mission statement is the 13th rule of St. Benedict, which says that we are to care for the sick as if they were Christ. And if you think about that, because we don't know where Christ is in our day-to-day life. And secondly, I always think about, even if you have to deal with somebody sometimes you don't like, you may wind up with that person in eternity or whatever that's going to be. And I mean, it's kind of like, we got rural citizenship here, and we're all in this together. This may be an encounter that you don't want to regret.
I remember something that Mother Teresa said, and I have this because I want to have it made in the bookmark for Christmas gift. She said this about AIDS patients, and she said each one of them was Christ dressed in a distressing disguise. And reminds me of something my grandmother used to say in Savannah, Georgia, when we were still riding in the back of the bus. She used to say, just remember, those white people are children of God, too. No matter how ugly they want to act. And I think that there's a lot to be said in that, and I want to go back. And I think also the question you raised about, do we have a monopoly on compassion? I don't believe so, and I agree with you that I have experienced enormous and deep compassion, particularly from Buddhists. When a person isn't a Christian, they're, in my experience, they tend to either be a Buddhist, at least in terms of the circles that I run in with. And so I don't think we have a monopoly on it. I do think that, boy, our faith, our Christianity, I think provides us with the capacity, if we let it, to both act on and have enormous compassion. I'm not sure I don't believe we have a monopoly on it. I don't think so.
Yeah. Even when compassion, excuse my appearance, I just dashed up the whole leg and back of my son who had no compassion. But it seems like even when compassion is pretty well established and matured within a society or a faith or a this or a that, the snag still becomes to cross over the line. Your grandmother was unusual in that. A Muslim may be kind as the Dickens or the next Muslim, but not too kind as the Jew across the street. And unfortunately, the Christian community cannot claim any exemption from that. We've had a history of beating up on anybody who didn't agree. So it may be that once you have climbed the first hill, there's another one behind it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, which takes us to the point I'm making is how do you link compassion to citizenship? See, it's one thing to sort of sit there and say, well, yes, I have compassion, or I have compassion for my family or those people that are closest in my community, but I really want to make this linkage between compassion and citizenship. I'm curious about, yes.
I think we've got a real problem with it because of the fact that we are part of a world community now, especially with communications being what they are and how, you know, people can connect so quickly and easily with people all over the world. We have to understand all these different people, and we don't even understand people in our own town. Mm-hmm. We live across the town, across the block, you know, the next block even. Mm-hmm. We've got a real problem with it.
Because?
Maybe we pay lip service to compassion, but we don't really practice it.
The thought that comes to mind for me when I was listening to the thing about TV violence the other evening, the forum, was that somehow we've lost sight of the connection that we have with other people, that we don't see how our actions or our inaction directly affects what happens. You know, I live in Indiana. What happens in California when with the Rodney King event? And that it really is a ripple effect, even though some isolated event happens in mm-hmm. Oklahoma City mm-hmm. or New York City. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good question to raise, because citizenship to me has something to do with how you act out what you believe.
What are some of the rest of you think over here?
I think very definitely compassion in citizenship is your life. And as a Christian, you have to live it. Often in your work, you'll come up against things that disagree with that, and it's your responsibility to say, I'm sorry, I disagree, and make your choice on your, whoa, excuse me. she wants a Pepsi. on your faith. For me, it's often a question I don't like to ask myself, but I used to have a preschool and deal with parents a lot, and there was one situation where they really wanted a preschool, babies. Well, actually, she was five, but the parents wanted to kick this child out, and I finally had to say, I'm sorry, I know this is not a Christian school, but I have to say, what would Jesus do? And you act on that.
I guess some of the avenues I think about in terms of citizenship are institutions or like government, which I've become somewhat cynical about. I keep struggling with it and keep trying to be more positive about some of the things that happen, and I don't take action the way I should. But there's institutions that in some ways or systems that work against us all, I think. And it's just difficult at times for me to think about and work within those institutions or systems.
You know, even in the town I'm from, yeah, you have all the government that I agree with. It's pretty cynical, a lot of it. But there's also a lot of good stuff in town. There's a great deal of volunteer work for example, a community house for the homeless is sponsored partly by United Fund, but a whole lot of it from the local community. And there's lots of ways we can show compassion by participating in these, either by giving or physical work and doing this sort of thing.
our citizenship is that we are called to be engaged in the world in various ways. I even think hermits are people who went off to do that. Some of these communities where they pray, they pray for the world. We need all the prayer that we can get, that's being engaged. But part of citizenship is to choose to be engaged. Did you know that in the last election in our country, 25%, less than 25% of them participated in that election? The last one we just had. I have a t-shirt that I have that I wear a lot. It's called "I'll Bet You Vote Next Time." I would feel a lot better about the outcome if people showed up. My mother, bless her heart, lives in Ohio, and she's decided that her job is to call all of her children before each election at 5 a.m. in the morning to remind us of how our grandmother and great-grandmother laid down across the Eugene Talmadge Bridge. Eugene Talmadge was a governor of the state of Georgia. And they got hosed and dogs got at them. You know, getting a call like that, you get up off your black self and go, oh. That's the least common denominator of being engaged. But I'm curious about this because it isn't just people of color choosing not to vote. And since I'm not a person that's Caucasian, it's like, what is it? Why don't people want to vote? Help me understand that.
I can't speak directly to why people don't want to vote, but one thought that pops into my mind is that there's a feeling that one person doesn't make a difference. Or that even a real small group of people doesn't make a difference. And that thought becomes bigger than anything else. When you recognize, like when you're talking about the volunteerism that happens, and the services that have sprung up out of people having compassion, somehow or another people circumvented the system because the passion or the drive or the desire to have something happen was bigger than you can't do it. And it's somehow, you know, me, I'm asking myself the question, how do I tap into that passion that has me say, yes, you do. I mean, yes, your contribution does matter, because if you don't believe it does matter, you're right there in drudgery.
Now at work, I hear a lot of people say, it doesn't make any difference who you vote for, they aren't going to be any good anyhow, basically is what they're saying. And there's a lot of that happening.
Along the same lines, I was thinking that you don't really know the person that you're voting for anymore. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, you've seen an ad or a flyer, you know, that lists, he has four children, you know, he's lived in town for 15 years, and blah, blah, blah. That's all you know about him. Mm-hmm. You don't know what his position is on there, unless you know the guy personally.
But that's where I think it becomes, I'm sorry, part of your responsibility to find out about the people.
How?
A lot of listening, a lot of research. I know it's a lot of work, but that's part of the responsibility in citizenship.
I'll never forget that question, and I do believe that this led to George Bush's loss of the election. During the second debate, there was a woman of color who stood up and asked him a very simple question. Do you know anyone personally that's lost their job? And could you talk about how that feels for you? And in his response, both nonverbal and verbally, the man lost the election. And he lost the election because he did not exude compassion. First he said, what are you asking me? So immediately there was that defensiveness. And he said he personally knew no one that had lost their job. But he had, you know, and then he sort of tried to come back from that question. But, and she said, and I don't want you to talk about what the other person next to you has done or will do. I want to talk about what did it make you feel like? And he could not go there with her. And I wanted to vote for George Bush. I'll just come out and say it. I wanted to vote for George Bush. But between that and Pat Buchanan, I could not, in good conscience. And that's my personal political point of view. But what struck me was the inability to have a sense of feeling and awareness. And I really was struck because even if he hasn't, didn't know anybody personally, which really surprised me. I just, you know, even at that level with that kind of money, people lose their jobs. So that really was a hard one to swallow, but the other was the ability to feel, to be with the person who may have less than you. And even as a president, you could call up and say, go drop me in the middle of the cap of where the lumber people are, and I just want to hang out with them, just to know what the deal is, and to not be able to respond out of that. And that's when I really started thinking about this linkage between the great work and compassion and citizenship. Yes.
What I have sometimes suspected maybe about myself, I can't speak for anybody else, but despite the reasons, well, my vote won't make any difference, or it doesn't really matter about all these lobbyists who really control things, what I sometimes wonder is if myself and mine, the people I know, family, if we are making it and have enough toys or survival things, whatever our status is, we are also often like George Bush in the sense that we really haven't made the leap from compassion about at a distance. We haven't been able to do that. And so when it comes right down to daily stuff, beyond mouthing it, as long as we're getting along okay, we're not passionate about the things that appeal to the commonwealth, the commonweal, the things that citizenship implies. And we have to get passionate about our society before anything is going to change.
Yes,
sometimes I think we have given into what I would call sort of a form of despair in a country which we do not acknowledge is changing and sinking in a sense from what it used to be. And we have lost the ability to understand that we do something because of what it does to us, not because of what it may do to achieve something in an election. So we vote. If you can be in that place, we vote because that's who I am. I'm a person who says, I'll try. And that actually fights my despair. That's what gives me hope, is taking some action instead of being passive about whatever's going on.
It's interesting because I was going to say before you said that being a citizen is two things. One is believing that there's a God. And then the second is taking action, that which we have the right to do, which is the right to vote, the right to write letters. I've written 20 letters to the president. I've never done that before, but I've written him letters, and I've gotten answers. I mean, you get those nice little, but somebody's reading them. Somebody read the letter, and I'm just happy to have voice and opinion, but I think I was in the San Francisco earthquake, which really, I don't wish that on anybody, but if you ever have the experience, it's you absolutely have no control. And it was in some of that moment I said, you know, in the end, there is a God. And at any moment, this could all go away. And so that was a defining moment in my life, because I was stuck in an elevator going this way. But you know what? It's interesting, and maybe this is what people say before they're going to die. I absolutely have an enormous sense of peace came over me. An enormous sense of peace. And the only regret I had, because I thought I was going to die, I thought, oh, this is it, this is really, because it felt like it was really over. I mean, it was like this. And I only said, I just wish I made it to Katie's third birthday. But that was the only regret I had. And in that moment, I felt totally at peace. But two things I learned from that experience is that it can all go away very quickly, and that we aren't in control. But we certainly can make a difference. But this hopelessness, despair question that you raised, Judith, is good, because I think that without some sense of hope, it's very easy to sink into despair. And I think that's what we're dealing with. That's probably part of the problem in our society. I'm doing a lot of work with African American young men and places like Boston and Los Angeles, and I have people say, you know, I just don't even care. There's no regard for life, because there's such a siege victim, I'm already done in already mentality. Some people are seeing making it to their 30th birthday as a major accomplishment. So part of the work, the great work, is to renew hope. And I often ask myself the question, and I don't believe that poverty is the common denominator in terms of impacting your ability or your capacity to have hope. Some of the most hopeful people I know are very, very poor. But they're enormously rich in spirit.
One of the other factors that jumps out for me about citizenship is that it's, I think lots of times it's easier to be the commentary on the sideline instead of actually playing in the game. And I feel like, at least where I'm from, that it becomes commonplace to take pot shots at the president or whoever is in political power, regardless of what party they are. And to somehow disconnect yourself from the work that person's doing, if it's good and everybody's in favor of it, it's much easier to pretend like you're in the game playing. But there's something about personal accountability, you know, like when it wasn't somebody we voted for, we disconnect ourselves from the process, or when, like you said, as long as I got my toys or the right number of things, I can disconnect myself from the have-nots in society. And that, for me, there's some element in here, when you talked at the, you made a comment about self-medicating, we've got to look at why the violence is happening. I think that's also a part of this whole thing, and somehow weaved in this is that element of despair. And I teach part-time, and once the student said to me, and I didn't like when he first said it, but he said, "You're perpetually perky." And I was like, "Oh, that sounds kind of like trite and like superficial." But the bottom line for me was, in having a conversation with him, and I'm a social worker, so people will say whatever they say about social workers, "You're altruistic, idealistic." But that's the only place I could go to. You know, I had a lot of other despair happening events in my life, but if the only thing you do have in terms of that which compels you is the force that says, yes, you matter, yes, your contribution makes a difference, and somebody calls me perpetually perky, I think that would stop people for whatever reason. And I want to just toss out there that some element of why we disconnect is because we don't want to see ourselves as having response ability, you know, that we do have the ability to respond, because if we do, then somehow or another we're compelled to have to do it, and if we don't, then we feel guilt,
shame. I don't know what goes in it for other people.
I think the other thing that it seems to me with the company nominators with citizenship is also that it takes a lot of effort. It takes extra effort in our society. I mean, you even look at voting. I think one of the reasons the voting turnout was so low is people don't have time. I mean, the polls in our town open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. A lot of people are at work. Or, you know, they got to get their kids to child care. We got a couple of people in family working. Get your kid to child care. Get to work. You got to be at work meeting by 7:30. You don't have time to be late to work, so you don't stop on the way to work. By the time you get off at 6 or whatever, you got to go and get supper ready. You got kids, you know, got homework. I mean, I think that goes into, there's extra effort even into voting nowadays. It's hard to vote.
Mm-hmm. Which is why there's a movement to have voting on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's an issue. But I think other areas of citizenship, like it, I mean, for me to deal with somebody who doesn't have housing or who doesn't have health insurance or who's a person of color in my community, I got to go way out of my way. I got to go out of work. I got to go out of my church. Mm-hmm. I've got to go out of my way. And if you try to do that, it's hard. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do it, it's going to take more time away either from work or from family or from leisure time.
And you're right. Some of us that don't have families every week, you know, we've talked about this, but I've decided that every young, you know, African-American male that tries to sell me crack cocaine in downtown Minneapolis, I use it as an opportunity to show compassion. And I've been very fortunate. I have two people that no longer sell crack cocaine. Because one person said, you're the first person that just even wanted to talk to me. And I basically said, no, I'm not going to buy this from you. And why are you doing it? And usually there's some legitimate reason for doing it. It was just a surprise for me. But I decided that that's what I was going to do. And so in the last year, I've gotten like 6 guys' jobs. One person says, keep sending these people. I call the Marriott, guide the Marriott. And they show up and they do their job and they have a rule. They can call me. Sometimes they call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'll say, you know, this is not appropriate. But well, what is it? You're not in jail, are you? No. I think even in our relationships, how minor they are, is it any big deal that I help 6 people get jobs in Minneapolis? Probably not. But it's 6 people that are making one incy-bincy step, you know, and maybe that's all you can do to show compassion. But anyway, I want to talk more about this. This is, we're on to something. I want to hear from this section of the room.
I'd like to mention one quick thing about voting. Where I live, for some of the local elections, they have done it by mail for 2 or 3 times now, and they had a better response by mail, and it's cheaper. And it's something a person could promote if they were interested.
Oh yeah, they are experimenting with that. You're right. Thank you.
I want to be better yet.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? All you need to do is check your name off. Like, yeah. You call, say, I'm so-and-so.
Assuming you have a telephone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on your TV.
But nonetheless, that's another session we'll deal on. Ideas for the way to handle voting. So, the question on the table is, what does compassion have to do with citizenship? I want to come back and take a look at what does compassion have to do with vocation.
To me, they're sort of related. The thing that we don't really talk about with citizenship is, citizenship at a basic level is engaging in a public arena somewhere, whether it's a voting booth or politics or something else. And compassion is a force that's not really welcome in the public arena. It screws up the rules. And so for those of us who want those two to be related, it involves getting involved with accumulating power to put compassion into an arena where citizenship's exercised.
Being vulnerable in a new, in a way that we're not used to having people be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And being strong in a way I don't think our church is prepared to be strong.
Can you say more about that? An example of a requirement for strength that the church hasn't helped in general.
I don't think we've helped. I don't think the church has prepared people for having confrontation that isn't destructive. I mean, it should be an ideal place to work these things out within the parameters of grace, knowing that when we leave this conflictual conversation, we're still brothers and sisters in Christ. So then enter the public arena with this new way of dealing with people with a compassion agenda in mind. I don't, in my experience, church folk, I worked as an organizer with churches who wanted to get involved in their public, their neighborhood, their city. And most of my work was helping people get over this and find ways that they could confront a public official or tell the police superintendent he was lying and that they knew he was lying, and so they needed to get past that to get to whatever it was they're trying to do that was ultimately motivated back in the church basement by a discussion about how can our neighborhood be more compassionate. And I think that's related to vocation too, because it's the same kind of thing. If in our work you don't feel your own sense of power and the power that's in you because you believe God's in you, then I don't know if you can bring compassion into your work unless it's part of the job description. Pastor, and so you're supposed to be.
Someone take a breath.
Well, he was saying, I think just about every work must have some kind of compassion in it, where you have to make a decision that maybe won't follow the rules because it's not good for the person that you're working with, whether it's that person that's barked at you and you have to back off and say, well, they're having a bad day, now let's start again or something, or whether in my situation where I have, I teach severe behavioral handicapped children in the Christ Public Schools, and these are the violent children, and we find weapons. Mm-hmm. And one day, one little boy came and said, I forgot to take this out of my pocket. And of course, you have to believe him because you know, and he had a fish hook. And you know he was planning to use that on somebody. Probably had nothing to do with forgetting. Mm-hmm. But then he got to school and realized if he got caught with it, he was in real trouble. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, now, I was supposed to have, you know, turn him in for any weapon of any sort, whether it's a knife or whether it's a, mm-hmm. one of these things, they forget what things they swing.
Brass knuckles?
No, I've seen brass knuckles too, but the, But okay, whatever, we're supposed to report him. So he had talked to me on his own, so I said, let's go out and have a talk. I said, okay, now, this is what I'm supposed to do. But I said, you tell you what, if you give me the fish hook and you here, I'll not say a word, and, you know, since you came to me, well, me and so forth, and then let's just let go of that. I said, I can't take it, get back to you. But if it's really something you've forgotten, your dad really wants it, he don't get it. Oh, no, that's okay. I could keep it. I end up with more weapons that way. But I haven't had quite a few.
What had inspired the sudden burst of altruism on his part?
That morning in the newspaper, a child had shot another child in school. And I talked to the children about the fact that if you can't trust yourself with a weapon, don't have one. Mm-hmm.
people because you can hurt someone. And, you know, and then he whispered to me that he had this thing and he needed up here.
Wow. So your passion for your work allowed you to take a very real situation, bring that in for the discussion, which led to a kid telling the truth.
Well, we have a behavior system that we work with, and the one child that stole in our room, I mean, at Holden, it was handled very beautifully, I thought. But what we have points that we give the children. I knew the child took the thing. I didn't even look for it, whatever it was. I just simply said that he's earning points but won't get them until the thing was returned. Because he'd already taken it home, and you're not ever going to see it again once it's home.
Mm-hmm.
We got it back. Because he wanted his points, he wanted his good thing, you know, because we have tricks that they have and stuff. So,
sure.
So it works.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. This, let's hear more from other people about this question of passion, compassion, and work.
I don't know that despair is the strongest thing where we are, because people think isolation, and they're basically upper middle class people. They're very happy with their jobs, with everything going on, and have a lack of connection with citizenship, especially being global citizens. And it's like just trying to bury my head and not face some of the issues that are there. And I guess I don't know where we are, but one of the things that can, and I think, work with people like that is the raising of the questions, the confrontation you raise sometimes just gets people defensive. I think very often, you know, when Jesus wanted to raise something, he said, let me tell you a parable. What do you think about the man who?
Yes.
And then told the story.
Amen.
And that's often what has to be done with people, is just raise questions about what they're doing about some of these, or raise questions about issues. Think about it.
Judy.
Well, I was just thinking that for many of us, the idea of work, it has to do with perfection and excellence and superiority. I hope you weren't talking about this when I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a burden for people.
Mm-hmm.
And it also comes out of a whole different theology framework than we say that we look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you're kind of stuck there, that you have to be successful, it's real hard to be just faithful and not see huge progress and multiple things happening. And that's our ethic. I mean, that's the ethic by which we live.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be superior, and therefore, you get the most toys.
And you get the most toys. But didn't someone say, they say the person who dies with the most toys still dies?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's on someone's t-shirt. Oh, Walt said that. The thing, and I laughed about that because you do still die. You have my father used to say there's only two things you have to do, go to the bathroom and die. And he said that even at the end of life, you may not have to do that. Some of the saddest and people with most despair I've met in my life, frankly, are people with a lot of money. And worse is people who come from a lot of money who've only seen that. Now, those are the tough ones. When we were all downsizing at Pillsbury and going off our ways, some of the people with the toughest time were people who had money because their parents had money, but they could not, their worldview of how it ought to have been for them totally fell through the cracks. I have a friend he went to work for 2 weeks afterwards because he couldn't deal with the reality.
I can see why somebody wouldn't have compassion or passion for their work, but the way you kind of define vocation is kind of our life's work. If you don't have compassion for that, you must have the wrong vocation. You gotta, I mean, that's an easy one. I mean, I think you gotta have, even if your vocation is hunting and fishing, you gotta have passion for that. If you don't have passion for your vocation, that's the wrong vocation.
It's, yes, no, go on, go on.
No.
Okay. It's amazing how many people I've met who have no passion for their vocation or have no sense of what their vocation is. It's amazing. I mean, one person I met who's had worked, you know, 30 years in the same place, and that's their life. When they got fired, I ran into them 3 years later, and it was like a different person. First of all, they looked 20 years younger. Guy had lost some weight. He was making half of what he made before. And he said his marriage had been full of life more than it had been in the first 30 years, or whatever the time was. Because he finally did something that he liked. Because almost he said, I was forced into it. And finally there was no other way for me to go but to get in touch with what that was. So some people aren't necessarily following their vocation and don't have any compassion. They're in it for the economic, and only the economic, rewards. And that's tough.